international finance markets, international finance law and practice. We are looking at the main international finance markets, which form the international financial system. We want to understand the origins, historical development and evolution of these markets over time, as well as the structure and operation of current markets, modern markets, and the key financial instruments, products, securities, which are dealt with on these markets. All of this is reviewed in the introduction document provided. We're going to look at the history of banking and finance, the international financial system, international finance markets, financial assets and instruments, international financial centres, global investment banking, international commercial banking, international financial markets, and then specifically we'll come on and examine in further detail the euro-dollar loan market, the euro-dollar bond market, project finance market, securitization and structured finance, and international financial derivatives. Everything is provided in the paper. We assume that you do not have any prior finance or technical expertise in any way. Everything is provided for you here. We are looking at international finance markets. These are the largest markets in the world. We want to understand the structure and operation of each of these markets. The key point is that with everything else, these raise difficult legal and regulatory issues. We need to protect all the rights and interests concerned, as well as the stability and continuous and safe and stable operation of the markets over time. The main problem that arises in this area is that these markets are so large, there is no single government or international agency that is large enough to authoritatively oversee or regulate these markets. Therefore, the markets regulate themselves on a market or self-regulatory basis. This is principally achieved through the use of trade associations. The largest participants in each of the market, that's the large banks, the large investment firms, they come together, they create a trade association amongst themselves. That trade association will then appoint the senior legal firms in the main international financial centres, either London or New York, but also increasingly other key centres around the world, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Frankfurt, and a number of others. The market then operates through the use of standard documentation, which creates a form of surrogate or proxy for formal financial regulation. In terms of the historical background and origin, we can understand that in terms of banking, international finance, international trade and merchant finance, merchant banking and investment banking. Banking originally begins in Italy in the 13th and 14th centuries. The key financial centres were in Lombardy, Florence, Venice and Genoa. The word bank comes from the bench. Banco was the bench that the bankers used to sit on. The first private bank was the Monte de Paschi in Siena in 1472. The oldest public clearing bank was the Casa di San Giorgio in Genoa in 1407. A lot of early modern banking comes out of the practice of Italian merchants around this period. I have provided separate materials, I do separate classes and presentations on the history of money and finance, and we look at the ancient origins of banking in Mesopotamia. But in terms of modern banking, we can understand that in terms of Italian practice from the 13th and 14th centuries onwards. International finance then emerges and develops in the large new city-states such as Lyon, Genoa, Flanders, Bruges, Antwerp. As trade recovers following the Dark Ages were essentially from the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West around 472 to about 1000 AD, we had a collapse in commerce and trade. All dealings, all exchange was simply based at the village level. there was no wider inter-country or intra-country trade or commerce of any form. That begins to recover from around the 1000s, 1100s onwards, and then that's the beginning of the new modern period. This is where international finance then begins to develop, mainly with the re-establishment of trade in these large city areas. And then what will happen is we have fairs within the villages and cities, and then we have great fairs across Europe where merchants come together in large international financial centres such as Bruges and Lyon, Genoa. We'll have a great fair which might last weeks if not months. The fairs then develop their own market practice, their own forms of finance, their own laws, which we call the Lex Mercatoria, and they actually also develop their own court system and payment and execution, delivery enforcement systems as well. These were became very sophisticated forms of practice. International trade and merchant finance then develops out of these new trade practices. The two most early important early forms of instrument were then the bill of exchange and the promissory note. The bill of exchange was a direction by one merchant to another merchant to pay a third merchant. The point simply was this: merchants are always dealing with each other. So one merchant is always owed money by another. That merchant wants to buy something from another merchant, so rather than pay gold or silver, the first merchant can tell the second merchant to pay the third merchant. If we record that in a small piece of paper the size of a large banknote, that becomes a bill of exchange. And what would happen is these bills of exchange were used in these fairs and great fairs, and the bill of exchange would pass all round the fair for possibly 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. At the end of the fair, you would then present the bill for payment to the original merchant against whom it was drawn, and he would make payment, while all other signatories to the bill were also liable on the bill. The effect of this was to create a highly specialist but very efficient payment instrument that allowed vast amounts of business to be conducted without the need for money to actually transfer. It was all done through these bills of exchange. What would then happen later? The City of London would become the largest international financial centre in the world, partly simply because of the trade business that was managed through London, also because London becomes the centre for the international gold market, but thirdly, because London emerges as this key international financial centre for bills of exchange. And the technical term was referred to as the Bill on London. Merchants anywhere in the world could conduct business for small and large amounts of money. They would then do so through a bill of exchange. That bill of exchange would be sent to London and it would be processed. And you'll see on the right hand side, there was two specialist sets of institutions that emerged. We had the acceptance house and the discount house. The acceptance house was a boutique bank that would accept the bill by signing it, stamping it, which added its credit to it, which made it as good as money. It turned it into a banknote effectively. And what you would then do is you would present the accepted bill to the institution, very often next door, which was a discount house. And what the discount house would do, this was another specialist bank, it would calculate the interest due that was still left on the bill. It might be a 1 month bill, a 2 month or a 3 month bill, possibly a 12 month bill. The discount house calculates interest for the residual period, for example, 12 months. It deducts that from the face value and it pays that. That is the discount. The discount value is the face value less the discount, which is the residual interest due on the bill. And this is how international trade was conducted for between 500, 600, 700 years. The bill of exchange was one of the most important financial instruments ever. Later on, subsequently, and this is developed in the paper, the bill of exchange will then emerge into the modern check. A cheque is simply a bill of exchange drawn on a bank, and this will be codified under the Bills of Exchange Act 1882, which codified all of the relevant laws in this area, and is specifically provided for under Section 73 of the Bills of Exchange Act 1882, that a cheque is simply a bill of exchange drawn on a bank. The other key instrument that emerges is the promissory note. A promissory note was an undertaking to pay, which is set out in a written form, virtually the same size as the bill of exchange. The bill of exchange was a direction to pay. The promissory note is a promise to pay. The promise to pay, the promissory note, will later emerge into the banknote, because all a banknote is simply a promise by the bank concerned to pay the face value of the bill. And again, this is codified under Section 83 of the Bills of Exchange Act 1882. The key point about merchant banking, investment banking, and commercial banking is that commercial banking is concerned with deposit taking and lending. A bank technically is an institution that will accept deposits from the general public and then advance credit on own account. It takes deposits, it pools them, and it lends them. That's a commercial bank. An investment bank is an accident of American English, which emerges in the early 1930s. This is covered on the right-hand side. Following the collapse of the New York stock market on 1929, we separate commercial banking and securities business under the Glass-Steagall provisions in the Banking Act 1933, which is going to separate commercial business and securities business. By an accident of American English, the new securities firms were referred to as investment banks because they were split from the earlier mixed integrated commercial bank. You'll actually see there in the text. So for example, Morgan, J.P. Morgan, had to split the Morgan Bank into what becomes J.P. Morgan Commercial Bank, and then Henry S. Morgan and Henry Stanley will form a separate investment firm called Morgan Stanley. That was in 1935. There's then a merger with Commercial Bank and Chase Manhattan Bank, which will subsequently acquire J.P. Morgan, which creates J.P. Morgan Chase in 1996. I outline the background to all of the key bank mergers, acquisitions, origin and evolution and development here and subsequently in the introductory document. The key point simply is investment banking is a market term. It means a securities firm. It means a securities house. It is not a commercial bank. It's not technically a bank because it cannot take deposits and advance credit on own account. The five largest investment firms that emerge subsequently will be Goldman Sachs at the top, then Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch. It was then Bear Stearns. Lehman Brothers was number four, and Bear Stearns was number five. The global financial crisis occurred because J.P. Morgan Chase will purchase number five on Wall Street, that's Bear Stearns, with the assistance of a $30 billion facility from the Federal Reserve. There was an attempt to have Bank of America purchase Lehman, but that fell through. Barclays Bank could then not purchase Lehman because of difficulties with securing waiver for the need for shareholder consent under British company law, therefore Lehman closes. Above that, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley convert their holding companies into bank holding companies so that they can borrow from the Federal Reserve Bank under the discount window facility. And the third largest, Merrill Lynch, is purchased by Bank of America instead. Merchant banking is a hybrid or combination form of early British commercial bank that then develops trade finance activities, mainly around foreign exchange business, bills of exchange, and then later were called letters of credit. And the letters of credit business emerges whereby you have two sets of banks, one in one country where a merchant is selling goods, a merchant in another country who's buying goods. And what will effectively happen is the banks assume the key role in dealing with all of the documentation and making the payment provision available. Legally, you don't actually sell the goods, you sell the documents which represent the goods, principally the bills of lading or bills of shipping. And what will happen is there will be confirmations of the quality of the goods, the volume of the goods. Those are transferred through the documents by one bank to the other. If the other bank is satisfied, it makes payment to the other bank. So through this letter of credit structure, you create a very sophisticated form of international trade finance, whereby we can move goods all around the world, basically buying and selling the deeds of title to those goods. But underlying that, we would essentially use bills of exchange and then subsequently electronic forms of transfer with checks as well. So we have the historical development of banking, international finance, international trade and merchant finance, merchant banking, which is a combination form of old trade finance, British banks that did commercial banking that then slowly emerged into securities business. So they merged the commercial and the investment banking. But a commercial bank only does deposit taking and lending. An investment bank only does securities business. A merchant bank can do both. We can understand the history of the international financial system in terms of key stages of development and crisis. We had the gold standard from around 1816 to 1933. We had the Bretton Woods system following the Second World War, 1944 to 1973. We had the petrodollar in debt crisis, 1974 to 1989. Asia and Russian crises, 1997 to 1998. And then the global financial crisis, 2007. 2008, and then most recently the coronavirus crisis 2019, 2020, 2021, and then possible future impending climate crisis. The key point to stress about the credit crisis, the global financial crisis, was that all of the reforms that were adopted following those events actually created the conditions whereby the international banks and securities firms were able to withstand the new pressures, additional stress created by the coronavirus crisis, and still continue to operate on an effective and stable basis and to provide all of the necessary funding and lending so that governments across the world could contain the coronavirus crisis. It may not have been possible to have managed the coronavirus crisis if we did not have the global financial crisis first, which created the conditions whereby the financial markets were in a stable and effective condition so that they were able to support society and communities across the world to manage the additional pressures created by the coronavirus crisis. I summarise in the paper the background to the gold standard, which created a stable international financial system that then collapses just before and after the First World War. That then ties in with the stock market collapse 1929. This then leads to the Great Depression in America, 1930, 31, 32, 33. Franklin D. Roosevelt becomes the president. He comes in and he promises to fix America by adopting all of the necessary laws within the first 100 days of office. This is then the basis for the Securities Act 1933, Securities Exchange Act 1934, the Banking Act 1933, which included the Glass-Steagall provisions we've already mentioned, and then subsequently the Bank Holding Companies Act 1935. That creates the basis for the American regulatory system. We then have the instability of the 1930s that leads to the Second World War, 1939 to 1944. Before the end of the Second World War, the authorities want to create an alternative, stable international financial regime to avoid the difficulties that had arisen during the 1930s, the financial and monetary conditions, instability across the world, which many considered allowed the emergence of fascism, which then leads to the Second World War. To try and prevent that occurring again, we're going to design a new international financial system, which was agreed under the Bretton Woods Treaty, which was agreed in July at the Mount Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods in North America. The authorities, this is 8-9 months before the end of the Second World War, the authorities know that they will, the Allies know that they will win the war, they just have to try to agree, design a new international financial system. This will be based on three key ideas. We will have an international bank for reconstruction and development to provide development funding. That becomes the World Bank Group. We will have an international monetary fund, IMF, to protect international financial stability. And we will have an international trade organization, an ITO. The American Congress, and I believe the French Parliament also objected to the ITO. Therefore, in place of that, we agreed a general agreement on tariffs and trade, a GATT, and that will come into effect and apply until we can establish a formal World Trade Organization in 1995, which will replace the GATT regime. This then establishes a stable international financial model for the post-war period. This allows for reconstruction and development across the world until the new instability at the beginning of the 1970s. President Richard Nixon, this is bottom left on the paper, is on the radio making a State of the Union address, and on 15th August 1971, he outlines a new economic package, and as part of that, he's going to close the gold window. And what that meant was that governments could no longer exchange dollar bills for gold. Under the Bretton Woods system, we had created a gold exchange standard whereby the value of the United States dollar was fixed to gold at $35 per ounce, with all other currencies being fixed to the dollar. So we achieved a stable international currency system locked, tied to the dollar, with an adjustable formal mechanism which would apply in appropriate cases, but generally all currency values were fixed. That put very substantial pressure on the American administration, especially following the Vietnam War, while other countries were also amassing gold, in particular in France. Because of that additional pressure, the Americans had to announce the closure of the gold window, which led to the collapse of the international currency system that had been set up under Bretton Woods. There was an attempt by a committee of 20 and an outline of reform document to try to design an alternative system that, however, collapses, and countries agree to move on to a fully floating system of international exchange in 1973, which is confirmed through amendments to the IMF articles in Jamaica in 1976. We then create the conditions for the new world of fully floating currencies, fully floating interest rates, with very substantial new levels of volatility and risk in markets at the beginning of the 1970s, following the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. This leads to subsequent crises. We have the petrodollar and debt crisis, 1974-1989. Many emerging economies borrowed very large amounts of money during the 1970s, but then with a downturn in the global economy at the beginning of the 1980s, they found they weren't able to service this. So we have the beginning of the third world debt crisis, with Mexico announcing on 13 August 1982 that it had to suspend payments. This then spreads to a large number of other countries in Latin America, the Caribbean, Africa, and the Middle East. There will then be a separate issue with Mexico debt and the collapse in the Tesibonos, the government bond market, in 1995, with the need for a market and international monetary support package. We then had the Asia financial crisis, on 2nd July 1997 with the collapse in the Thai baht. While this begins to recover initially, the concerns spread to a large number of other new markets, tiger economies in Southeast Asia, which leads to the Asia financial crisis. A lot of this was tied to non-commercial lending practices, which was known as crony capitalism, with fundamentally weak banking and supervisory and regulatory control systems. This will then spread to the Russian crisis, which leads to a Russian default and a number of large pieces of litigation actually commenced at this time as a result of this, and we'll come back and look at some of those cases specifically, including the Springwell decision. That then takes us up to the global financial crisis and then the coronavirus crisis. International financial markets, we can understand in terms of the money markets, the capital markets, the euro dollar markets, currency markets, financial derivatives markets. We've also got the gold market, commodity and shipping markets, and insurance markets. We can also then, within each of these, identify all of the key financial assets and instruments, or financial claims, that make up these markets. And what I've done is I've come up with a separate five-part taxonomy to explain this, and then a number of subdivisions within that. So we have coinage and currency. We have coinage, banknotes, foreign exchange, certificates of deposit, which are deposit which evidence a large underlying deposit with a bank, which can be transferred as a separate money market instrument. And then we have account credits or bank credits. Most money in the world exists in the form of a bank account. Legally, a bank account is not money, it's only a claim by a bank, by the account holder against the bank. And we'll come back and look at that later in some of the key judicial decisions which apply with regards to this. In terms of credit and payment, we have promissory notes, bills of exchange, checks, traveler's checks and banker's drafts, banker's acceptances, which are accepted bills of exchange we referred to before, and then new forms of electronic and digital money, which then takes us into distributed ledger technology, DLT, cryptocurrencies and financial technology, fintech and regulatory technology, regtech. We have public debt, government bills, government bonds and gilts, corporate securities, corporate bonds and shares, depository receipts. On risk and investment assets, we have forward contracts, financial futures, financial options, swaps, and then there's three key types of swap contracts: total return swaps, TRSs, credit default swaps, CDSs, and credit spread swaps, CSS. We also have credit-linked notes, CLNs and repackagings, collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, and then insurance policies and gold, specie, and commodity markets. We'll come back and look at all of this in further detail. I've provided a historical chapter and a structural market chapter with separate tables which outlines all of this. The largest part of international finance and financial markets will be carried out through the principal financial centres. We can understand this in terms of the growth of key financial centres across the world, with London remaining the most important, largest collective aggregate centre, which is the basis for many of the largest markets in the world. We can also understand this in terms of the main sub-markets which make up these core international financial centres. So we have international banking, investment banking, international bonds, equities, foreign exchange, derivatives, asset management, gold, bullion, insurance and marine services, all of which is carried out in these main international financial centres. International investment banking, the securities business that we identified before, is made up of a number of key services and functions: equity and debt underwriting, market making and trading, asset management, advisory services, trade finance, foreign exchange and financial derivatives, prime brokerage, which is providing a range of services for the main hedge funds across the world, and then other ancillary activities. The key, or one of the key issues that rose with the collapse of Lehman Brothers on 15th September 2008, Lehman was the fourth largest securities firm on Wall Street. It was always the largest provider of prime brokerage services to hedge funds across the world. So the difficulty that arose was that with the forced closure and uncontrolled and managed closure of Lehman in New York, many of the largest hedge funds in the world found that their securities, their security portfolios and their cash was all locked in to the Lehman Brothers administration and Lehman Brothers winding up. This caused massive difficulties across the world because many of the hedge funds had their assets held with Lehman and then they could not access those until the winding up process had been carried out. I then explain the development of international investment banking, identify the key institutions in the United States markets and then the largest current firms, as well as the key changes that have occurred in regulatory terms. So we had the Glass-Steagall provisions of the Banking Act 1933. Those are then substantially reversed under the, this is on the right hand side, Financial Services Modernization Act or the Financial Competitiveness Act 1999. That was sponsored by Phil Graham, Jim Leach and Thomas J. Bliley. So it was referred to as the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. This allowed for the establishment of financial holding companies, FHCs, which could own banks and securities firms. So we effectively bypass the restrictions established under the Glass-Steagall Act in 1933. That's effectively reversed in 1999, 66 years later. We also then have, following the global financial crisis, we'll have the Dodd-Frank and Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, renamed after Barney Frank, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, and Chris Dodd, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. This essentially re-regulates the market after the modernization and deregulation in 1999. So basically 11 years later, we're going to deregulate and then re-regulate. There's also another statute called the Financial Futures Modernization Act, 1999, which very substantially relaxed the derivatives markets in the United States, the OTC derivatives markets, and many consider that it was a combination of the Graham-Leach-Bliley and the Futures Modernization Act that created the conditions which led to the global financial crisis that then led to a substantial reaction and re-regulation under the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act 2010. I then explain the development and evolution of British merchant banks, with many of the most famous early firms, and then how these would merge and the markets restructured. We essentially had a big bang of market deregulation in New York around 1975-76 and then again in London around 85-86. We had a substantial relaxation of the structure and operation of the London Stock Exchange. We allowed overseas firms to come in and own and purchase London stock brokers. We abandoned the fixed commission system and we moved on to electronic forms of trading away from pit or auction trading on the floor of the stock exchange. I've mentioned some of the main institutions there. You'll see Kleinwort Benson, Fleming's, Hambro's, Morgan Grenfell, N.M. Rothschild, Schroeder's, S.G. Warburg. I then look at the nature and development of continental universal banks. The main distinction between the European system and the UK system was that in Europe, the largest banks would conduct securities business directly. We call that a continental or sort of single institutional model, whereby a single institution or a universal bank would carry out commercial banking and securities together. On the same basis as in America in the 1920s before the Glass-Steagall provisions. In the United Kingdom, we separated commercial banking and securities business. We had separate dedicated institutions carrying out these. In London, it was a matter of market practice. In America, it became a matter of regulation under Glass-Steagall until the Financial Competitiveness Act 1999. I then explained the background to the development of the largest big four securities firms in Japan with Nomura, Daiwa Securities, Nikko and Yamamichi. We then look at international financial crisis again and the nature of the specific contracts that were involved with the credit default swap, CDS, collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, and then CLNs, the credit linked notes. The paper separately considers the nature of international commercial banking, banking and banks, international banking, the development of international banking, international commercial banking activities, and bank regulation, especially with the development and revision of the international capital regime established by the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision in Basel, Switzerland. This essentially begins following its establishment in 1974. The committee will then produce a first capital accord, Basel I, in 1988. That's revised under Basel II in 2004, further amended following the global financial crisis with Basel III in 2010. And then there's a finalisation package, which is also adopted 2017. This is referred in the market to as Basel 4.5, although the Basel Committee insists it's not a separate form of Basel formulation. It's only a clarification of the earlier rules that were adopted. I also refer in the paper to the main crisis that arose, 1974, Franklin National, Bankhaus Herstatt. Then later we have Banco Ambrosiano, BCCI, Lehman Brothers, and all of the development of the new regulatory regime, which is adopted up until and after the global financial crisis is outlined here. We then look at international financial markets and specifically focus on specific sub-markets with the loan market, loan structures, loan facilities, issue procedure, loan syndication and documentation, the Eurobond market, bond structure, facilities, parties and documentation, issue procedure and listing, and then liability, project finance structure, advantage and disadvantage, parties, documentation and negotiation, securitization structure, advantage, parties and documentation with negotiation, and then financial derivatives, market structure, advantage and disadvantage, international swaps and derivatives association, standard documentation, and specifically the 1992 and 2002 master agreements, and then the relevance of derivatives to the global financial crisis. All of that is covered in the core introductory paper, which explains the background to the nature and structure of the international financial system and all of the international financial markets that we examine in further detail in this course.